So I'm here in Dublin at the Festival of Science and delighted to be with Pamela Ronald. Welcome to Dublin, Pamela. And Pam is the author of the book Tomorrow's Table and a plant geneticist working in UC Davis. Could you tell us a little bit about your work there, Pam?
Well, I'm pleased to be here. I work on rice. Rice is an important crop. It feeds half the world's people. And I'm interested in understanding the genes that underlie resistance to serious diseases and tolerance to environmental stresses.
And you've also been involved in the Golden Rice Project, is that right? The vitamin A fortified rice.
Actually not. That is a project that was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation and carried out by groups of scientists, including Ingo Petraikis in Zurich.
And why was that particular strain of rice developed?
So vitamin A deficiency is a serious problem in many regions of the world. It's estimated that 500,000 children go blind every year because of lack of vitamin A and associated diseases, and half of those children die every year. Much of the problem is due. They don't have balanced diet. They eat rice 3 times a day. And there have been methods of vitamin A supplementation developed, and that is useful, but it doesn't reach too often to the rural areas. And often these consumers don't have access to carrots or leafy greens, which we all take for granted in our diet. So consequently, it's been a very intractable problem for a really long time. So the Rockefeller Foundation funded a scientific program about 20 years ago now to try to genetically engineer provitamin A into the rice, and it's been quite successful. Groups of scientists have worked together and developed new varieties of rice that are golden, and that gold color is because they're producing this provitamin A, and it's estimated that 1 cup of golden rice a day would allow that child to survive. It's expected to be released next year or the year after, so it's a very exciting development.
What are the other most important genetic traits that have been engineered into crops so far, would you say?
Well, there's several important traits. One of the smaller traits is genetically engineered papaya, and that was developed by a local Hawaiian. The issue with papaya in Hawaii that it's susceptible to a devastating viral infection, so plants get diseases, as do animals. And there was no method to control this disease, no farming practice, and no variety. So they engineered a small snippet of viral nucleic acids into the plant, and that essentially immunized the plant against viral infection. So it's similar to the concept of being immunized against smallpox or polio, although mechanistically it's different. But the farmers then are able to plant these papaya, and they're completely free of infection, and they have been for the last 15 years. So it's been a great boon to papaya farmers in Hawaii, and it's credited, these new varieties are credited with saving the papaya industry there. So that's a relatively small, one of the largest genetically engineered crops that's grown globally now. It's genetically engineered cotton, and it's engineered for inbuilt resistance to a insect disease. And the reason this came about, a couple reasons really, is that cotton uses something like 25% of the world's insecticides. Half of those insecticides are thought to be quite toxic, potentially carcinogenic, or some are even known to be carcinogenic. And cotton is a very important crop all over the world. And about 50 years ago, farmers started using a small bacterial protein called Bt. And this is a very specific insecticide. It targets just the pests and not beneficial insects. And for this reason, it's been a favorite tool for organic growers for many years. In fact, it's one of their most preferred pesticides that organic growers use. So geneticists engineered this gene producing this compound BT into cotton plants. And that many farmers are growing that now, and it's massively reduced the amount of insecticides in the environment, and it's been credited with dramatically reducing insecticide poisonings and enhancing insect biodiversity. So that's been a very exciting development as well.
So you're actually saying that genetic engineering can in fact be good for the environment, can actually, and in fact is, helping to reduce the use of toxic chemicals in farming?
It depends on the crop. So genetic engineering, we really can't generalize about genetic engineering or genetically engineered crops, because each crop is different. The purpose of genetic engineering is different for each crop. So it's really like any seed varieties. Breeders have been developing seed carrying different genes using many different methods for particular environments. And so the goal, what I think is an important goal, is a sustainable agriculture, and to focus less on how the seed was developed and think more about the long-term goals. So, well, of course, the food has to be safe to eat, or cotton. You don't even eat cotton, but it needs to be safe for the environment. And also, can we use less land and less water, which are very precious resources? Can we foster soil fertility? And can we feed the poor and malnourished? Those are the critical questions that are important for any type of seed variety, whether it's developed through genetic engineering techniques or other types of genetic alterations.
So your husband, Roel, who you wrote the book with, is actually an organic farmer. How does that sit with the controversy around genetic engineering and the fact that certainly in most places in America and Ireland as well, I think, the majority of the organic movement and the official position is to be opposed and exclusionary towards genetically engineered seeds?
Yes, so the National Organic Program standards in the United States, as well as in all countries so far, I think, do not allow the use of genetically engineered seed. So any other type of genetically improved seed is allowed, but there's a specific prohibition against using genetically engineered seed. So my husband, who is an organic farmer, is not permitted to grow genetically engineered seed. If he was, he would not be able to certify his crop as organic. So we're not advocating for changing organic standards. I think that would be difficult now, because many people in the organic community have an idea that they don't want genetically engineered seed. But organic farming produces less than 1% of the produce consumed on this planet. And so what we're advocating for is a sustainable agriculture. We're addressing the other 99% of food that's produced.
What would you say to people who are concerned about gene flow? In other words, the spread of novel genes or genetic material into the nature from these crops?
Well, I think that our native ecosystems are precious and dwindling, and we really need to conserve the biodiversity. But this is an issue whether it's genetically engineered or not. So any seed variety, whether it's genetically engineered or developed through hybridization or mutagenesis or embryo resco or many of the hundreds of different types of genetic alterations, that pollen will flow if there's a sexually compatible species. However, virtually everything we eat is considered exotic. It's genetically altered. It's been brought in from elsewhere. And what you see is that domesticated species, you don't find those in native ecosystems. I don't think there's ever been a case where a domesticated species has established in a native ecosystem, because they're crippled. You know, they only grow if we water them and fertilize them and take really good care of them. And they have really big fruits that make them fall over, and so they're not amenable to weediness. So where I live in California, we have this huge, massive Central Valley where we grow all kinds of exotic fruits and vegetables, and it's surrounded by some very pristine ecosystems. And you never see a corn plant growing up in the Sierra Nevada, or even in the foothills, which are adjacent to the farm fields. But we have a special situation in California because there really aren't any sexually compatible species grown in the wild, and it's very arid, so virtually no crop plant can grow. But there are places in the world where you have sort of traditional varieties, which are called land races, that are growing in close proximity to agricultural areas. So, for example, Mexico, they have many different types of maize varieties that farmers grow in the area. And then they have large production in Mexico of many different types of genetically improved crops. And when I say genetically improved, I'm also talking about
conventional breeding.
Yeah, conventional breeding that's accepted by the organic community for hybridization, for example. So hybrids are this really strange type of human manipulation where you bring two genetically distinct individuals together, you make crosses, and you end up with a seed that farmers love because it yields a lot and it's highly resistant to disease. And so organic farmers are allowed to use that. But it's been grown in Mexico for quite a long time now. And sure enough, the pollen flows into areas around to the older varieties. So certainly you're going to find pollen if you have closely related varieties growing next to each other. But that's an issue whether it's genetically engineered or not.
Some people are very concerned that really genetic engineering is just being used by big corporations like Monsanto to control the world food supply by introducing expensive seeds that the farmer has to rebuy each year that are proprietorial and that they can't save themselves. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think we don't want just a few companies controlling the world's seed supply. We need to foster many different types of breeding programs, small businesses, research at public universities. And that's an important question, I think, for the Department of Justice, for example, in the United States. However, these large corporations have been developing seeds since the 1940s. They've been developing hybrid seed, which farmers do not replant. They're really forced to go back to the company every year to buy the seed. And as I mentioned before, organic growers also grow hybrid seed. So then you have to ask the question, well, why do they do that? Why do they go back to the company every year? And the reason is they like the seed. So my husband's a farmer, and he always likes to point out, like, we're not stupid. So farmers are buying the seed because they see use for it. And the situation is very different in developed countries where most farmers use some kind of hybrid seed than less developed countries. So, for example, I work on rice, and rice is, there is some hybrid rice, but most farmers, for example, in very poor parts of the world, use rice that's self-pollinated, and they produce their own rice every year. But genetic engineering, for example, doesn't prevent that self-pollination. So that's an important distinction I like to make.
Okay. And your work, so most research work is quite independent. It's actually taking place in universities, public universities. It's publicly funded and not under the control of Monsanto.
Well, my research has been publicly funded for 20 years. So many plant scientists get their research funds from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the National Science Foundation. I actually have National Institute of Health funding because I work on very fundamental problems, that trying to understand how organisms become immune to disease. But still, there's a lot of research going on in corporate companies. So Monsanto, Pioneer, BASF, they all have very, very large breeding programs. And so I think we do need a balance of breeding and research programs in the public domain as well as the commercial sector.
And what's your view on, I think we were talking earlier that Chagas in Ireland, they're applying for a permit to trial blight-resistant potatoes here in Ireland. What would you think to that? Is that a good approach for potatoes?
I think that potatoes are very important for the national identity here, and you don't want to have another famine. And that's not to say that there aren't many important methods to look at to develop potatoes that are resistant to this truly devastating fungus, as you well know. And I think genetic engineering is one tool in the toolbox, and it would be foolish not to explore whether the scientists can develop a resistant resistant potato.
And just finally, Pamela, what traits do you think will be important in the future to look for genetically engineered crops?
Well, we know that we need to grow much more food using the same amount of land and much less water. And the reason is that most of the arable land on the earth is already in production, and we already have water supplies that are increasingly strained. So we can't simply expand production by expanding the farmland. So we need to be more efficient in producing the seeds and the food. And we also have challenges from climate change. So we're going to see increasing droughts in some areas, increasing floods in other areas, different types of pest outbreaks, disease outbreaks. So there's always employment for the plant breeder. And we scientists all over the world are using many methods, not only genetic engineering, but trying to address these problems.
Okay, well, thank you very much for answering those questions, and good luck with all your further research, and enjoy the rest of your stay in Dublin.
Thank you, and keep up the good work with Skeptico.